Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. We are in the New York ratification debate still. We've only done two parts. There are a few more. And this kind of tends to get a little long, the New York ratification debates, not in necessarily because there's that much testimony, but what I'm trying to provide you is why the New York ratification debates are so lackluster. In contrast, so let me just tell you that as far as GR's opinion here, Virginia is the most clarifying. They get into debate. I mean, it's almost like they come close, as I pointed out, they come close to having some duels and so forth. It was very hotly contested. Patrick Henry, George Mason on the anti-federalist side, James Monroe on the anti-federalist side, Madison, Nicholas, Randolph, some of the names, I believe Pendleton. Yeah, Pendleton was on the federalist side. It was very, I mean, we're talking about these men knew political science and, you know, the realities of government of the day, and they argued it to the nth degree. And so we get the Virginia ratification debates. If you're going to read any, that's the one you want. Now, I will tell you, it's several hundred pages, the New York ratification debates. Several hundred pages. As a matter of fact, I have that open right here, and it is 140 pages. 140 pages, the New York ratification debates. In contrast, I could, and maybe I should, what I'll do is I will appease you just to give you an idea. For those of you who really want to dive in and read some of these things, I believe the biggest, yes, it is, the Virginia ratification debates is the most voluminous ratification debate out of all of them. And while Word is calculating exactly how many pages, it's 431 pages. So it's like well over twice the size of New York or North Carolina and so forth. So I just want you to understand, if there is one that you want to read, it is the Virginia, because they knock each other down. It is a true brawl. They don't hold any punches, and they're not playing games like Hamilton in the New York ratification debates. Again, I tell you, Hamilton was waiting for the news of Virginia's ratification to come through, because every state ratified. There wasn't one state that didn't ratify. And he knew that Virginia would be pressed. I mean, they would have a hard time not ratifying, knowing that George Washington would be the Republic or this new government's first president. Why would Virginia deny him and themselves the honor and privilege of giving this man this recognition? I mean, it's kind of a cruddy reason why, but it is a reality that most people go, wow, you know, the reason why we're not joining, you know, could be pretty good, but nobody came up with a good reason not to ratify. So not doing it, you better have either a good reason, or since you have the, you know, the best way to probably say this is with the fact that George Washington, a Virginian that would be the president, I mean, that puts a lot of pressure on these men to say, we've got it. It's got to be our guy. And in some ways, Virginia was the big kid. The reason why they went down the path that they did and didn't go way out to lunch is because New York and New England wasn't driving this government. And I'm telling you that the New England states were big government federalists, and that's what ended up happening and what created the Alien and Sedition Act. So anyway, enough of my analysis. What I want to do is just kind of fly through some of the obligatories. This show is also sponsored by republicreview.org. You will never find that domain until we actually have a couple of states that are coming on board. We will get that domain set up because the ownership of republicreview.org is the state government. So when the states start coming together, they'll share the responsibility. I will be giving them this domain so that they can communicate to the world what they are doing in forcing the federal government into compliance. That's the whole point of Republic Review, getting government into compliance to the Constitution. We are a republic, which means we are a nation of laws, and we must adhere to the law. So, if you're caught up in the news cycle and the stacking of the court and D.C. becoming a state, oh my, we're actually, when we get to Virginia, we're going to go into the exhaustive arguing back and forth of why they did not want to have the D.C., the federal government, sitting in a state. It had to be an autonomous zone, and why that's so important, okay? So when we get to that in the Virginia ratification debates, we will prove that, and they got to remember that everything that they're doing is unconstitutional. Everything. All of these laws, these EOs, over 90% of the money being spent by the federal government is fraudulent money, and we are not on the hook. We need to stop this. We need to stop and derail this train, and we need to get everybody back onto the constitutional train and moving in the right direction. And we can do this because the Constitution is a compact. It's not some living document of the annotated Constitution that they can willy-nilly just give themselves power. These powers do not exist. The states can take these powers back and must. If you want to understand Republic Review, go to reclaimingtherepublic.org. Go to the Constitutional Articles page. The very first three documents will walk you through the argument, the description, and the flow. That's how these three documents are done. The first document is the argument. The second goes through the description of the process. And this third one is basically a flow chart. It's an image. It kind of gives you, oh, wow, okay, it makes sense. It's just like any other contract dispute where the parties are saying, hey, our subcontractor is violating our contract. And now we're going to force them into compliance because you are the parties. You are the judges and the jury. Anyway. And we'll get into more of all of these academic facts. There is no 90-second, there is no one show that I could actually give you in 1 hour that would seal the deal to where you are 100% on board and that you know without a doubt. It takes a few shows to do that. It takes content. It takes academic evidence, empirical data to prove these things to you. Now, that's why I'm not here to entertain. That's why I don't care if, you know, I'm the most polished guy, if I don't have everything, you know, with the smartest wit and coming up with these good, pithy, you know, meme-worthy comments that, you know, come from some of these brilliant people that we have a great opportunity to be associated with. And Candace Owens, she's brilliant. I mean, Glenn Beck, I mean, this guy is a smart businessman. He's a smart writer. He's an entertainer. He got me hands down. He's better than me on entertaining, but he's not in the right spot. He's definitely wrong, and I have no problem telling him he would be to his face. He's wrong. Same with Mark Levin. Mark Levin is a fool playing a fool's game, but he's a great entertainer. Same thing with all of the other conservative entertainers. They don't care about solving the problem, folks. They care about you listening to them and hopefully buying their products so that they can make money. How much money do these guys make? Who do you think they're serving? Now, they're good people. They have a good heart. They've got a good business sense, and they're making good money. And in all honesty, if you really want to test the mettle of these men, put it on their feet, put it on their doorstep, prove this wrong. And they'll come up with reasons why they won't get involved with it. None of it will be, as far as I'm concerned, a legitimate argument. Because this is what Jefferson and Madison did, and this is exactly what Madison kept on defending. And when you read, and we'll get into this, this will be a part of the academic evidence, because we just started. We're going through the Constitution, we'll get through the resolutions and a lot of other issues. You know, historically, we try to do all of these things in order, and we will prove to you that this is an irrefutable argument. We must. If we're going to save our Constitution, if we're going to save our liberties and our children's liberties, the liberty of our posterity, if we're going to do that, we must initiate republic review. The states and state legislators must initiate that. They're the ones that have to do this, and they have the constitutional power and authority to do this. Let anybody tell you, like a lawyer, like Mark Levin, oh, they can't do that. And I'm here to tell you that Madison says otherwise. Are you going to believe Madison? Or are you going to believe Mark Levin? There's your challenge. You're going to listen to somebody who's making money and has everything to gain by keeping the solution at bay and allowing the goose to continually lay their golden eggs? You'll understand why. And this is a systemic problem in the conservative ranks. Either you care about the solution or you care about what's going on your plate. We'll be right back after these two promos. Thank you so much. If you run a business or an organization, you already know email is an essential tool for communicating. If you're interested in reducing your overhead and increasing your productivity, I personally recommend you look into AdLocal email marketing services. AdLocal has a special offer for my listeners with email services that start at $10 a month for your first 1,000 addresses. If you want to increase customer retention, grow your market presence, track your statistics, and improve your engagement with your customers with modern, elegant emails that express the personality of your business with emails that integrate with your website, you need to contact AdLocal, and they handle the rest. Take it from me. AdLocal offers the best solutions for all organization sizes, and they lead with their pricing and the 24-hour customer service. Folks, it's time to call AdLocal at 866-88-ADD-LOCAL or visit them on the web at www.addlocal.com. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
Friends, if you have any questions or comments, we have our 24-hour comment line at 425-270-5416.
Okay, so in the previous episode, I actually covered some of Hamilton's better statements in the Federalist Papers compared to what he says and his assertions in the Ratification Debate. So I will get into that as well. But before I do, I need to tell you, we've got a comment line, 425-270-5416. Question? Comment? Don't worry about trying to get it done during the hour, or trying to formulate your thoughts, or, you know, getting those emotions in check so you can articulate really well. You don't have to do it during the hour this show airs. All you've got to do is just call 425-270-5416. First thing in the morning, last thing at night. You know, collect your thoughts, get it all figured out, and boom, and we will air that in its entirety. Prove me wrong. Anyway, the reason that's there is if you do have a question, you need some help, I'm here to help, and I'm not from the government. How about that? Anyway, we are in the last of the last three states. The next state we'll do is North Carolina, and then we'll do Virginia. And so in the last bit that I read in the New York ratification debates, it was Mr. Williams, and he was talking about these general powers, perceived general powers in the preambles and then in the necessary and proper clause. Now, I'm here to tell you that as this came down the pike, there's no doubt in my mind that John Marshall started using these exact same arguments that this anti-federalist Mr. Williams asserted. Here's the interesting thing about the anti-federalists. Many of them became federalists, big government federalists, once the Constitution was ratified. When you look at those who went into government from Virginia, that Patrick Henry supposedly picked the best anti-federalists to be the two senators. Both of those men did not care to support the Bill of Rights. Now that they were sitting at the seat of power, they were trying to figure out how they could get a piece of it. That's how these people played. I mean, it was typical politics. Anyway, so in the last thing we kind of covered was this huge assertion by Mr. Williams. The next thing we're covering is the next day. The first person up is Mr. Smith. And he's going to talk about, oh, boy, we got some problems with jurisdiction. This is the part that really requires our attention. And so we'll go through his assertion, and then we'll go through Mr. Livingston's refuting of that and talking about checks and balances. Mr. Livingston was a delegate, one of the three, I believe, that was at the Constitutional Convention with Hamilton. I forget who the other one was. I think it's Lansing. I think there's Livingston and Lansing. I think they were the two other than Hamilton. I'd have to go back and look. But anyway, because I'm bad with names. This is what Mr. Smith says. We are now come to a part of the system which requires our utmost attention and most careful investigation. It is necessary that the powers vested in government should be precisely denned, that the people may be able to know whether it moves in the circle of the Constitution. It is the more necessary in governments like the one under examination, because Congress here is to be considered as the only part of a complex system. The state governments are necessary for certain local purposes. The general government for national purposes. The latter ought to rest on the former, not only in its form, but in its operations. It is therefore the highest importance that the line of jurisdiction should be accurately drawn. It is necessary, sir, in order to maintain harmony between the governments and to prevent the constant interface, which must either be the cause of perpetual differences or oblige one to yield, perhaps unjustly, to the other. I conceive the system cannot operate well unless it is so contrived as to preserve harmony. If this is not done, in every contest, the weak must submit to the strong. The clause before us is of the greatest importance. It respects the very vital principle of government. The power is the most efficient and comprehensive and that can be delegated and seems to be some measure to answer for all others. I believe it will appear evident that money must be raised for the support of both governments. If, therefore, you give to one or the other a power which may, in its operation, become exclusive, it is obvious that only one can exist only at the will of the other and must ultimately be sacrificed. The power of the general government extends to the raising of money in all possible ways except by duties on exports. In other words, It is the state's power and ability to all goods that they are exporting externally, they can lay taxes. To the laying taxes on imports, lands, buildings, and even on persons, the individual states in time will be allowed to raise no money at all. The United States will have the right to raise money from every quarter. The general government has, moreover, this advantage. All disputes relative to jurisdiction must be decided in a federal court. And then what he's basically saying is that the federal court will rule in favor of itself, as it always does. Thomas Sowell even points this out. Don't think you're going into an unbiased court. That court is an appendage of the federal government, and they work together. So anyway, Mr. Chancellor Livingston responds with this, and this is where the turn goes to checks and balances, and the argument becomes focused on checks and balances moving forward. But the point on which gentlemen appear to dwell with the most attention and concern is the jurisdiction of the United States and individual states and taxation. They say a concurrent jurisdiction. By the way, I want to point out that nobody even addressed Mr. Williams' assertion on these general welfare and defense. Just there was no good refuting. It kind of went unchecked. Anyway, they say concurrent jurisdiction cannot exist and that the two powers will clash and one or the other must be overpowered. Their arguments are considerably plausible, but if we investigate this matter properly, we shall see that the dangers they apprehend are merely ideal. Their fears originate in a supposed corruption of Congress. For if the state governments are valuable and necessary to the system, it cannot be imagined that the representatives of the people, while they have a single principle of honesty, will consent to abolish them. If I proceed here to prove the improbability of corruption, I should only repeat arguments which the committee have already heard most clearly and copiously detailed. The fact is that in our present state of society and under the operation of this Constitution, interest and integrity will be connected by the closest ties. Interest will form a check which nothing can overcome. On interest, sir, we rest our principle, hopes, and safety. Your state government has the unlimited power over the purse and sword. Why do you not fear that your rulers will raise armies to oppress and enslave the citizens? Clearly, because you feel a confidence in the men you elect, and that confidence is founded on the conviction you have the tyranny is totally inconsistent with their interests. You will give up your state legislatures everything dear and valuable, but you will give no power to Congress because it may be abused. You will give them no revenue because the public treasures may be squandered. But do you not see here a capital check? Congress are to publish from time to time an account of their receipts and expenditures. These may be compared together, and in the former year after year exceed the latter. The corruption will be detected, and the people may use the constitutional mode of redress. The gentleman admits that corruption will not take place immediately. It operations can only be conducted by a long series and a steady system of measures. See, that's interesting because it, turning the ship and diverting and perverting the Constitution took a long time. I mean, John Marshall didn't steer us completely, to the left. He slowly started turning the ship and others continued to slowly turn. And now we are bearing 180 backwards towards enslavement. Anyway, back to what Mr. Livingston is saying. These measures will be easily defeated, even if the people are unappraised of them. They will be defeated by that continual change of members, which naturally takes place in free governments, arising from the disaffection and inconsistency of the people. A changeable assembly will be entirely incapable of conducting a system of mischief they will meet with obstacles and embarrassments on every side. The one thing, because we were undermined by men in government, in the federal government, as well as external, but we were undermined, and it didn't happen overnight, but it happened incrementally to a point where after the Civil War, this is where Britain was capable of coming in and able to actually, because after the Civil War, the Southern states owed Britain a lot of money, and Britain was not going to go unanswered in not getting paid, and the constitutional amendment said the United States would not be accountable for paying that. So what ended up happening was they actually violated the 14th Amendment by creating corporations and paying Britain back and creating a permanent payment train to Britain. We'll be right back after these two promos. Thank you so much.
Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org. And let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic.
To become a citizen, one must take an oath to support and defend the Constitution. Those of us who are naturally born citizens are obligated and duty-bound to fulfill the same oath even though we're not required to take it because it is implied upon us at birth. This is why I cannot emphasize enough the importance in supporting businesses who are supporting our Constitution. We have to stop supporting businesses that have chosen to hide behind political correctness, and obviously we must stop supporting progressive businesses who are working to undermine our republic and our Constitution. Do not let businesses or organizations convince you that they are supporting the Constitution by supporting protests for social justice. By definition, social justice is the distribution of wealth, opportunities, and privileges within a society. In other words, they're calling for socialism, which is incompatible with individual liberty and individual sovereignty and our Constitution. With that, please consider supporting businesses who advertise on this show and this radio station. Don't forget, you can call our 24-hour comment line to ask a question or to speak on any topic. Dial 425-270-5416. Okay, so next up in the arguing deck is Mr. Hamilton. And Mr. Hamilton tries to expound upon checks and balances. And remember, in my last episode, I provided a couple of examples of how concise Mr. Hamilton was. So now I'm going to read Mr. Hamilton talking about checks and balances. And this is how he says this. After all, our doubts are suspicious and speculations on the subject of government. We must return at last to this important truth that when we have formed a constitution upon free principles, when we have given a proper balance to the different branches of administration and fixed representation upon pure and equal principles, we may, with safety, furnish it with all the powers necessary to answer in the most ample manner the purpose of government, the great desiderata, or it's probably Spanish or Latin, anyway, free representation and mutual checks. Mutual checks. When these are obtained, all our apprehensions of the extent of power are unjust and imaginary. What then is, again, he's marginalizing and he is condescending, unjust and imaginary. What then is the structure of this Constitution? One branch of the legislature is to be elected by the people, by the same people who choose your state representatives. its members are to hold their offices 2 years and then return to their constituents. Here, sir, the people govern. Here, they act by their immediate representatives. You have also a Senate constituent constituted by your state legislatures, by men in whom you place the highest confidence in forming another representative branch. Then again, you have an executive magistrate created by a form of election which merits universal admiration. In the form of this government and in the mode of legislation, you find all the checks which the greatest politicians and the best writers have ever conceived. What more can reasonable men desire? Is there one branch in which the whole legislative and executive powers are lodged? No. The legislative authority is lodged in three distinct branches, properly balanced. The executive is divided in between two branches, and the judicial is still reserved for an independent body who hold their offices during good behavior. This organization is so complex, so skillfully contrived, that it is next to impossible that an impolitic or wicked measure should pass the scrutiny with success. Now, what do see how condescending he is? Now we see how far we've drifted from this and how evil has been permeated in our government. So, and he's standing here marginalized and saying this is impossible. So either this man was either that poorly informed or he was that nefarious, that pernicious. Anyway, why do they say we are, this is him again, this is Hamilton, why do they say we ought to limit its power, to disable it, and to destroy its capacity of blessing the people? Has philosophy suggested, has experience taught, that such a government ought to not be trusted with everything necessary for the good of society? Now, at this point in time, these men had already been, you know, they've already seen Teitler's cycle of democracy. You know, every 200 years, every time in a democracy form of government, the people end up granting themselves welfare to where they stop working and they become so corrupt that government fails. Well, what they created would not allow this, because if it's not an enumerated power like welfare, using the public treasury to benefit people, benefit corporations, or even benefit states, it's not there in the Constitution, so it's unconstitutional to do. So they were that well protected. We were that well protected. So what happened? Well, Hamilton, who had this protege, or I should say, he was his protege, Mr. Marshall. John Marshall basically took all the guidance from Hamilton as to what he needed to do to move the government, to help it aggrandize itself and slowly but surely violate the government's powers and usurp the state's powers to where the federal government became, you know, this Leviathan. Anyway, sir, when you have divided and nicely balanced the departments of government, when you have strongly connected the virtue of your rulers with their interest, when, in short, you have rendered your system as perfect as human forms can be, you must place confidence. You must give power. Now, this is what Hamilton said in the Federalist Papers. If, then, the courts are to be considered as the bulwarks of a limited constitution against legislative encroachments, this consideration will afford a strong argument for the permanent tenure of judicial offices, since nothing will contribute so much as to this that the independent spirit in the judges, which must be essential to the faithful performance of so arduous a duty. And then he goes on a little bit, and that was Federalist Paper 78, and he then goes on in Federalist Paper 85. This is a very powerful one. It's very succinct and it's short. This is really good, but it's a Federalist paper, no legal bindingness. I mean, it's just insightful. We may safely rely on the disposition of the state legislatures to erect barriers against encroachments by the national authority. If the foregoing argument is a fallacy, certain it is that I am myself deceived by it, for it is, in my conception, one of those rare instances in which a political truth cannot be brought to the test of a mathematical demonstration. So, I mean, he's so solid that the state governments are going to create these barriers against this government, and they never do. I think he knew this. Why? Why is it that they never created these barriers? It's easy, my friends. These people who were going to the federal government were the best of the best. These were the brightest. And so when we look at, you know, Madison going into Congress and all of these men going into the Senate and Congress and filling these executive seats and so forth, this was their best. I mean, the states had the second best, right? The best went to the federal government. And so it was almost a challenge of integrity and honor when all of a sudden you had to create this safety net. You had to create these barriers to protect the states. It was almost an insult to say, oh, Hamilton or actually Madison and all these other men that are in the federal government, they're going to steal our powers. You see my point? There was this mutual respect because of these men and who they were. It took a long time for a cabal to be created between the federal government and the state government, for the federal government to convince the state government to allow it to violate the Constitution. And the state has been twiddling its thumbs ever since. This is why we have to get the states to do their cotton-picking job. Now, this next one kind of is a part of the invasion or the importance of this. And so this is Mr. Hamilton talking. To what extent shall these resources be possessed? Now, actually, let me go to the beginning of this paragraph. I'll read a little bit more to lead in for peace of war and all of this. Let anyone compare the expense of supporting the civil list in a state with the expense of providing for the defense of the Union. The difference is almost beyond calculation. The experience of Great Britain will throw some light on this subject. In that kingdom, the ordinary expense of peace to those of war are as one as 1 to 14. But there they have a monarch with his splendid court and an enormous civil establishment with which we have nothing in this country to compare. If in Great Britain the expense of war and peace are so disproportioned, how wide will their disparity be in the United States? How infinitely wider between the general government and each individual state? Now, sir, where ought the great resources be lodged? Every rational man will give an immediate answer. To what extent shall these resources be possessed? Reason says, as far as possible, exigencies can require, that is, without limitation. A constitution cannot set bounds to a nation's wants. It ought not, therefore, to set bounds to its resources. It's kind of like, you know, I think there was one point in time during the convention, the Constitutional Convention, where they basically said, well, we will limit the army to only 5,000 men, regardless of the situation or case. And I think Washington made a comment to say, well, as long as you limit the opposing forces that attack us to be less than this amount. In other words, he was basically pointing how stupid they were in trying to create limitations to, you know, the cost of having to fight and defend a war, when, you know, you have to base it on what the threat is. Anyway, moving on, Hamilton goes on and says, unexpected invasions, long and ruinous wars may demand all the possible abilities of the country. Now, I am telling you, and I'm giving you this, because when we look at the cost of this invasion and not expending the military on our southern border to stop this, I mean, just go do the data pull and find out how much this invasion has been costing us over the past, what, 3-4 decades. You will find that having deployed the militia and stopping this invasion And getting rid of all of these invaders would save us an insurmountable amount of money. But instead, we're allowing ourselves to be ruined. We'll be right back after these two promos.
Have you taken the time to watch our presentation on YouTube that provided an irrefutable argument of what we have to do to save our Constitution and our Republic? I know it's over an hour and 30 minutes, but you only need to watch the first 30 minutes. If you take the time to watch this presentation, I promise it will change your paradigm regarding what our Constitution is and what we have to do if we are going to save it, our liberties, our sovereignty, and our republic. We already have answers to most of the questions that you might think of after watching this presentation, and we want to help you get to a point where you have a profound understanding of the audit and republic review process. This is why our bullet overview and flowchart of both the argument and process is available on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. The sooner you get informed, the sooner you can get involved and make an impact. So go to ReclaimingTheRepublic.org to the Take Action page. That's where you'll find the video. Thank you so much.
To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires two-thirds of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to ReclaimingTheRepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. All right, so I'm going to kind of help paint this picture a little bit better. We're dealing with an invasion that's been going decades over our southern border. And the Constitution is very clear. We have an immigration process that a person must apply to become an immigrant to come to America. We used to have kind of an open policy that as long as you came here, we would be able to do that. But that policy and that openness has been several times overran by the southern border. I will invite you to go look at the historic usage of the term Operation Wetback. Now, this was something that was done, I believe, by Herbert Hoover and FDR. Sorry about the name. You know me in names. Anywho, if you go and research, because the Depression was being so affected and that the migrant workers at the time, because they were allowed to come up as migrant workers, they were supposed to go back home, but they didn't. And so they knew this. They knew that these migrant workers would come up and try to figure out a way to stay, and they wouldn't go back home. They'd continue to make more money because the American dollar was worth more, and they became basically rich, sending their money home to supporting their family. Now, the fact of the matter is, when you look at the powers delegated to the federal government has control over the migration of people, immigration, and they have uniform laws on immigration. There is nowhere where they have legalized. You can get to our shore, you can get to our border, you come here, you're on the path of becoming a citizen. No way. There is no law that exists like that. The fact of the matter is, if you come into America by not applying as an immigrant or using a visa, a legitimate visa from your host country, then you are illegally entering America. You are invading. Now, an invasion is when you have a bunch of unwanted people. Well, let's quantify this. What is a bunch? 100? Is that an invading force? How about 1,000? How about 1,000,000? There is no doubt in my mind when you look at the force of people coming across our southern border, that is an invasion. You cannot define it any other way. This isn't even refugees. Refugees is a completely different status where people are identified as indigent and they're unable to provide for themselves because of the ravages of war, disease, or what have you. And the government, whether that be the United States, and this is all unconstitutional, by the way, we never delegated the powers to allow refugees to come to the United States. It was via a treaty with the UN. I've gone into the details of this several times. That is all unconstitutional, but I'm telling you that refugees is a different process as well. Refugees aren't people that just cross our border. Those aren't refugees. Refugees are identified as people who need assistance as a block of people in a given country. What we have are people who are coming here because they've been told that if they get across our border, they get the handout. To be clear, there is no handout. The government does not have the ability to provide handouts. That should be church's responsibility. If the churches want to take care of the people, that's one thing. Then go take care of them in their host country. We have laws, and a republic is based on the rule of law. Anybody who doesn't support the law of the land, to me, is in contradiction to, you know, our form of government. Anywho, so what we have coming across our border is clearly an invasion. And so what Hamilton here is stating is that when you have an invasion, unexpected invasions, this creates a cost to your country, whether it's the deploying of the military or the militia at this point in stopping this invasion, then that's what you have to do. Because if you allow them to stay, they become a greater burden. They don't speak the language. They start drawing upon education and now requiring special handling because they don't speak the language. They don't try to assimilate. They become a greater and greater burden, thinking and what they believe that they have a right to when they don't. The Constitution is clear. If an invasion occurs, the federal government is required to protect each state from it. And in Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution, Congress has the power and must call forth the militia to repel invasions. Article 1, Section 8, Subsection 15. So let me get back to what Hamilton is saying here. Unexpected invasions, long and ruinous wars, may demand all the possible abilities of the country. You got to look at invasions as actually creating the demand of resources of the taxpayers, where we're actually flipping the medical problems they're bringing in. Understanding why we must protect ourselves instead of allowing them to ravage us by invading. Shall not your government, this is Hamilton again, shall not your government have power to call these abilities into action? The contingencies of society are not reducible to calculations. They cannot be fixed or bounded even in imagination. Will you limit the means of your defense when you cannot ascertain the force or extent of the invasion? Even in extraordinary wars, a government is frequently obliged to call for supplies to the temporary oppression of the people. Now, in this particular case, this invasion, all we've got to do is get the militia down there and stop them and say, we don't care where you came from, you're not coming here. And all the people that have gotten here, we're going to have to get them. We're going to have to round them up, and we're going to have to send them home. Period. They're invaders. They have violated the law. They are the antithesis of somebody here supporting a Republican form of government, a representative and rule of law government. Anyway, I know I get really passionate. And because when I get really passionate on shows like this, it takes me to editing just to get the dynamic peaks and everything else, because I have to do everything myself. A show like this may be an hour long, but it may take me 2, 3, sometimes 4 hours to edit these shows just because of all the dynamic peaks, because I get so passionate. So I just want you to know that, you know, it's not just quickly snap done, you know, out of here, I'm done, we're good. No, there's a lot more involved in trying to get these, you know, decent audio out when I actually send these things out. That's why I pre-record, so I can get the editing done right, or at least give you the optimum output. Anyway, later on Saturday, the next day, June 28th, Hamilton starts getting into the Supreme and or the Supreme Law, the Supreme Jurisdiction. And here he goes and says, I maintain that the word supreme imports no more than this, that the Constitution and laws made in pursuance thereof cannot be controlled or defeated by any other law. The acts of the United States, therefore, will be absolutely obligatory as to all the proper objects and the powers of the general government. The states, as well as individuals, are bound by these laws, but the laws of Congress are restricted to a certain sphere. And when they depart from this sphere, they are no longer supreme or binding. So what he's saying here is this certain sphere are these delegated powers, very specifically. In the same manner, the states have certain independent powers in which their laws are supreme. For example, in making and executing laws concerning the punishment of certain crimes, such as murder, theft, etc., the states cannot be controlled. With respect to certain other objects, the powers of the two governments are concurrent and yet supreme. I instanced yesterday a tax on a specific article. Both might lay the tax. Both might collect it without clashing or interference. If the individual should be unable to pay both, the first seizure would hold the property. Here the laws are not in the way of each other and are independent and supreme. And so this is where he kind of gets into how they can be concurrent, state and federal government, supreme. But he is clearly pointing out that anything that is in pursuant to the enumerated powers of the federal government is supreme over all laws. This is why when the federal government and the Bill of Rights was applied by the 14th Amendment to the states, that states could not pass laws respecting the expression of religious expression, the freedom of speaking, the freedom of assembly, the freedom of commerce. When your state governors pass laws and took away your constitutional rights of commerce, peaceable assembly, religious worship and expression, and those types of things by making you lock home and stay at home, they have violated your constitutional rights. Now, I wrote an article about this, and it's all about martial law in the 21st century. It's on my constitutional articles page. Go read it. It is very clear that states do have a right to protect us, but they cannot suspend everybody's constitutional rights. Every single one of these governors and every single one of these legislators that have supported these types of laws have violated their oath of office and must be removed. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the republic, and we need your help. God bless. Folks, as you know, online fraud is on the rise, and it's more important than ever for your new and existing customers to be able to determine whether they are using a website with a secured connection. If you didn't know, Google mandated in 2017 that all data submitted to its linked websites must be secure with SSL certificates. Without SSL certificates, your site is listed by Google as not secure. In other words, without these certificates, your site will be harder to find, and this will impact new traffic and ultimately your revenue. Whether you're a blogger or in e-commerce, AdLocal will help protect your website from all forms of data breaches, phishing scams, and build a secure environment for your businesses, big or small. Contact AdLocal by calling 866-88-ADLOCAL
or visit them on the web at www.adlocal.com for custom pricing.